6 minutes after three. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host for Juneau Afternoon. My first two guests are coming to us by telephone from beautiful downtown Sitka, and they are Ellen Frankenstein and Martina Kurzer, both of whom just recently finished work on a film about a mural, which is up on the side of the middle school in Sitka. Hi, folks.
Hi. Hi.
So tell me a little bit. We're going to see a TV show tonight, I think, at 8 o'clock that, Ellen, you were the producer of, which is the story of the making of this mural by 200 and some odd citizens of Sitka?
Correct, plus a lot of work in the schools using like a mixture of art forms to get kids thinking about the issues.
And Martina, you were part of the crew that came up with the concept, I think?
Yes, we actually originated at a health summit where citizens come together and think, what can we do to make quality of life better in Sitka? And we identified the fact that not enough attention is paid to interpersonal violence and the consequences of this, unfortunately, way of life in Alaska. And that we need to do something about that, and we wanted to make it a positive project. So we thought, well, a mural would be a cool idea, and lo and behold, a year later, we had the mural on the wall.
And you were
lucky. Was a fantastic process.
You were lucky enough that a professional muralist happened into the midst of your project, right?
I wouldn't say. We did a national call, and
our
goal was actually to combine national artists working with local artists and community people. So we had a wonderful artist named Eliseo Art Silva, who's really trained in social justice mural making.
And so was the design of the mural then his or whose?
We all gave input. As I said, we did this project called Invisible Stories, which is kind of a stealing from a national thing called Post Secret, where we invited community members to submit art and concepts around things like, you know, three things that aren't talked about in the community, your definition of respect, and all that material and the work we did in schools influenced what the artist created.
And there was another component. In May, the artist came to Sitka, especially, and in fact, we had a second artist as well. So both of them were in Sitka, and they had a community workshop called Mural in a Minute. And he asked us questions like, what are the important colors that you want to have in there? What are the shapes that you want to have in there? What are the issues that you want to have in there? And in fact, all these things showed up later again in his draft and design.
Now, unlike lots of murals, there are actually words in this one. At some point, rather obscurely placed in the mural is the word choose, and also the word respect is on a bottom of a skateboard in one part of the scene.
Yep.
And that side of, kind of sets the thing. But there was an interesting point about the mural was that it was deliberately designed so that you can't look at it and get it. You've got to stand there for a while.
Yeah, you really need to stand and work and figure it out. And there are a lot of components that you do not connect directly to each other. However, there are some helps, colored patterns help. There are some black and white symbols that represent respect, how different cultures design respect, or picture respect, and there are others that show different characters that are important in our community. And then there's still other where you scratch your head and say, but why is that there? Like, why is the chicken in there? Yeah, hey, the chicken is, and that's something I learned, is a folk symbol, a Russian folk symbol. And instead of having the double-headed eagle there that speaks for oppression and more violent, more of a violent past, we have a very peaceful Russian chicken in there that goes together with the Filipino, Ellen, help me, what is it, the Filipino bird.
Uh-oh.
And then on the other side, we have the raven and the eagle. So we have the beautiful, beautiful balance that marks our own little town history here.
The film ends with the placing of the mural. So I'm wondering, how has Sitka taken to it?
Well, every time I drive past there, my heart makes a little skip, and I said, oh, gosh, it looks so beautiful. It's so brilliant. The colors are so brilliant. And I recognize it, of course. It's a perfect location, and it brings me great joy.
And also the way we did part of it, as you saw the film, part of it was paint by numbers. So over 200 people helped paint the mural. Plus, like, when we went into the schools and we did stuff with kids where they did drawings and gave ideas, everyone who contributed something to the mural feels connected to it. And for myself, as a filmmaker trained in community arts, what I find is really important that an object has connection, because if you're not connected to it, you just might drive by it.
No. Yeah, and at least we have 200-plus well-educated guides that have this personal relationship to not only to the object of the mural, but also to the stories behind that, and they really see the stories, the little hidden links, and that's what makes it super excited, because there's so many hidden little links and hints, and that makes it very exciting. And even for us, going back and looking at it, it takes us back to the story part.
And also, I want to say about the making of the film was it wasn't made by one person. I mean, I sort of saw it through as a filmmaker, but it's got layers of different people involved and different stories. And the way it was made, where people were kind of pushed to, sort of like I had students interviewing folks that they normally wouldn't interact with. And so there was this kind of collision of people both painting the mural together and working on the film.
And there was a collision of generations, too. At one time, I was painting next to a 12- or 11-year-old, and that was a great joy.
One of the interesting things about the film is that it's very much point of view. There's no place in there where you lose consciousness, really, of the fact that you're watching film. You're kind of almost a participant in the creation of the mural. I think that came about because you were working directly with the people's voices rather than any interviewer or anything like that.
Right, and I also, like, within the film, we talked about it. We have some of the struggles. I mean, the struggles to get through the project. Because one thing about taking on anything that's just an idea and turning it to something and involving community members, it's complex, and there's times that it's really rough and things don't go perfectly. And so we really wanted the film to help model some of what that community process is about and what it means to use art for social change, which I, again, is still something really important in Alaska, that it's great to have beautiful art, but it's also good to have beautiful art that asks us questions and pushes us to take journeys that we wouldn't take otherwise.
I guess one of the things I'd ask, since you obviously have dedicated a lot of time to this concept of art creating social change, is how do you know when you've achieved success?
That's really hard because it's kind of qualitative. I think when you're creating conversations and you see some behavioral change, but that's a good question. What do you think, Martina?
Well, I think we will see who will show up to the march here on Thursday noon. If it's like 60, 70 people that we had last year, or if it's maybe 150 people. So for me personally, one sign of success is that it's way easier for me to talk about this issue outside of my work field. And I was at the local radio station here this morning and recorded something, and it was about sexual abuse and child abuse, and it was not a problem to talk to the news director about this and to get it into the program tomorrow morning. And so there is more openness in the community, to more willingness to discuss these otherwise unfortunate issues.
So some of the proof comes on Thursday. That's the reason we scheduled this to run on 360 North tonight at 8. Is because it's kind of designed to help folks realize that Thursday at noon, there's going to be a march in 122 communities around the state, including Juneau. Ours will start in front of the state Capitol building. You're going to be in Sitka as well.
That's correct. And in fact, this morning I heard that co-book signed up. We have 123 places in Alaska.
Oh. And Huna's got one.
Okay, so one of them is in Huna. Hello, Huna.
Yeah, and I think also Martina and I were talking before we got on the phone, is if people want to organize a march, they can. And what's the website?
There's a website, chooserespect.alaska.gov. And this morning I was in a teleconference, and it's still possible to sign up events, and even if Thursday is not a good day, but Saturday would work, please go there, particularly Gustavus and Tenneke. They have not signed up yet, so there's still opportunity to do so. And bring it up to 125 communities.
Okay, so watch the film tonight at 8. Join the march at noon on the 29th. Thank you, ladies, for coming on the show and telling us this.
Well, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye. Well, Tina's telling us to respect, and that's the theme of the presentation that you'll be seeing tonight at 8 o'clock. As the Layers of Change, Sitka's Choose Respect Mural Project is airing tonight on 360 North. And also, remember, March 29th at noon is the Governor's March, Choose Respect marches that are happening all over the state. Ours will happen, begin in front of the State Capitol building and go down to the harbor. And everyone is invited to come out and join. My guest in the studio now is Emily Wall, a poet who is giving a presentation on March 28th, tomorrow night, at 7 o'clock at the Egan Building up on campus as part of a program called Wildlife Wednesdays. Emily, what kind of things are you going to do at this presentation?
Thanks for having me on today.
You bet.
I'm basically going to be reading poems from my new book. It just came out a month ago. It's called Live Aboard. And Tina asked me to read poems and focus particularly on wildlife poems. Tina Brown is the director of the Southeast Chapter of Alaska Wildlife Land.
Okay.
And she asked me to give it a title, so I came up with Communities of the Wild. So my focus will be kind of looking at the way we interact in various communities in this kind of environment. So I was living on my boat at the time that I wrote the book, and so looking at the way we live on docks, which is very different than the way we live in houses and neighborhoods, the way that we interact with wild communities when we're out cruising on our boat, and the way all of those communities intersect in places like the dock and harbors and, you know, all kinds of places up and down the coast.
One of the things that's come out in a couple, three interviews that I've done fairly recently is the richness of the culture in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that arises from the fact that being closed in a way, we form community because we're more or less forced to get along with each other in many senses. And I think our the Sitka piece that we just talked about, it's a film about the making of a mural down in Sitka, and 200-some-odd Sitkins came together and helped build the mural, not counting the students that helped design it and things like that. But Southeast Alaska has a history of that kind of thing. We have a tendency to come together. Mm-hmm. And now you're saying that even our wildlife is community-oriented? You see this as a poet?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think the book is looking at particularly how when you're in a liveaboard community, you're living on the dock, or you're cruising, which we did for 4 summers, you create these intense transient communities. You're on a dock for 24 hours, you're buying some beer, washing your clothes, everybody else is doing the same thing. And because you have this short amount of time and you're so isolated, I think, which is a commonality with Juno, you form relationships very quickly. You need each other. You need to transfer information. That's no one else to talk to. You just quickly interact with each other.
Plus, some of those people are also following the same path you are, so it's like you have a moving kernel of a community going from place to place.
A little bit, yeah. And it really strikes me as being a lot like bird populations. You know, we sort of move with the weather, and we come in to particular places and feed and, you know, mate possibly and get to know each other and those sorts of things, and then we move on. So I think the liveaboard community is very transient and very migratory in the same way that a lot of bird populations are, and certainly we interact with the wildlife as we're out too.
How long have you lived aboard?
I don't live aboard right now.
Not now, okay. How long did you live aboard?
I did live aboard for 4 years. So we lived in Juneau, and my husband wanted to do graduate work, and we just couldn't get ourselves to leave Juneau. We loved Juneau so much. So we finally came up with this crazy idea to buy a boat, because we knew if we lived on a boat, we could stand living in a big city again. So we bought this boat, lived in Vancouver for 4 years. Well, he did his graduate work, cruised up and down the coast every summer, and then we sailed the boat 1,000 miles back home.
Vancouver, B.C.
Vancouver, B.C.
Okay, you didn't go inland. All right.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry. We're at UBC, yeah. And then we cruised 1,000 miles back home to Juneau and brought the boat back here.
Mm-hmm. How long? How long's the boat?
It's 37 feet. It's a 37-footer.
So, okay, all right.
It's pretty good size.
Enough room for two people to go to opposite ends when you're mad at each other.
Yeah. You can sort of still chuck things at each other, but you get a little bit of space.
Yeah. I have good friends who are cruising. As a matter of fact, we had them on the show here a little while back. They were in Costa Rica at the time. They're going around the world.
Wow.
And they're on a 35-footer, I think, so...
Awesome.
Anyway, quite a little tour. So, more about your poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to give it? Do you have a short piece that you could kind of give us a little shot at, so that our appetites are whetted for tomorrow night?
Sure, absolutely.
Wonderful.
I'll read a poem about Desolation Sound. We did a lot of cruising in Desolation Sound, which is the sort of nirvana of cruising territory. It's wonderful. Lots of gunk holes, islands, that kind of thing. In this particular harbor we came into, we went to bed that night, woke up, and there was like 10,000 jellyfish in the harbor with us. It was unbelievable. You could have walked on them if you could walk on jellyfish. So this poem is about that. It's called Grace Harbor, Desolation Sound. When we wake the next morning and look over the side to check the anchor, jellies, jellies, jellies. The water around us is a thick carpet of moon jellies, each little orb pulsing, rising and falling in the tide swell. Even though we know better, we can't help stretching out our hands, reaching down. Who could resist the moon if it came down in its 1,000 little bodies and surrounded us? Sometimes we need to be chosen. Sometimes we need for belief to be out of our hands.
Mm. What an ending.
Thanks.
Yes. So you were chosen in many senses, I think, to be a poet. On your website, you talk about the fact that when you first came to Alaska a few years back, that you were new to Alaska and new to being a wife, and that that kind of was the subject of your poetry.
Yeah, that my first book called Freshly Rooted, I wrote over kind of the course of about my first 7 or 8 years in Juneau. And my husband and I got married, and I think like a lot of people sort of said, hey, let's go to Alaska. We have $50 in a truck, right? And so we sort of have this long epic story about the truck breaking down and us pushing it on to the ferry, you know, in Bellingham and coming up here. And we thought we would just stay for a year. But of course, we fell in love with Juno. And it was an interesting time of intersection where we were newlyweds and had fallen in love with this place and the identity of Juno and trying to understand Alaska and being Alaskans or starting to be. and also starting to be married, to understand my identity as a woman, a married woman. All of that kind of came together in that book. It's really a book about identity.
So it's also, I think, a book about joining a new community and forming a very small community of two.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're doing much the same in many ways. But yeah. I'm sure that along the way, if this is not your first book, that you've matured in some ways as a poet. Can you talk a little bit about how that maturation process happens?
That's a great question. I hope that I've matured as a writer. I like this book better than the other one, so that's probably a good
that's a
sign,
good sign.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that a lot of things happen to mature as a writer. Certainly, I spend a lot of time reading and trying to learn from poets. I have sort of the best job a poet could possibly have. I teach poetry. I get paid to do that. So I spend a lot of time studying it. But I think actually one of the things I've been thinking about lately, particularly as I'm preparing for this reading, is the way that giving readings has changed my poetry a lot. Before I wrote that first book, I had given one or two readings in grad school and a few here and there, but not a lot. And after that first book came out, I gave a lot of readings, and I realized that I was thinking a lot about what the audience responded to, what they liked, what they remembered. I would have people come up to me even a couple years later and say, I was thinking about that poem. And what I noticed was it was the narrative poems. People really were drawn to the stories, which makes sense. We remember stories, of course. And not that I think we should wholly shape our poetry for our audience, but I care a lot about audience, and it's really made me think about the power of narrative poetry and the way that we need stories, all of us need stories, and the way that they help us connect to each other and create communities of stories. And so I think this book is a lot more narrative than my first book, and that's partly just based on, I think, the way that I've seen people read the work.
So at the presentation tomorrow night, you'll talk about your poems and read them, or what will people experience?
Yeah, exactly that. I think the fun thing about a poetry reading is that all poems have a story behind them, even if the poem is not a story. And so what I really enjoy when I hear other poets read is hearing a little bit of background. What was the story behind this poem? What's the framework for it? What were you thinking about at the time? And so I kind of like to do that a little bit as I'll probably read 16 or 17 poems, and I'll kind of talk a little bit about where the poem came from or the story behind it or just sort of information around it, and then I'll take questions if anybody has any.
And the presentation is from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock on March 28th. It's in Egan 221 and 222, not the big room. It's more intimate, a little bit smaller setting. And there will be refreshments.
Mm-hmm.
And Tina's telephone number is 523-5402, I think, is what it says here.
Mm-hmm.
And people can get a hold of her. And also they have a website. Just Google Alaska Wildlife Southeast, and it'll probably come right up. So, and then are there plans? You'll be selling the book, of course. Mm-hmm. Are there plans for other presentations from your material?
Possibly. You know, Tina's been so wonderful. The Wildlife Alliance is doing really great work in Juneau, and she's very connected to the community, and this is the second reading I've done for them. She's been so supportive. Jonas at the downtown library called me, so we're trying to set up probably something. Maybe
he's a guy
fall.
To work with. He's been
a guy.
On the show a couple times.
And Wendy at UAS just suggested maybe going on her radio show, so I might do that later in the month.
Okay.
That's what we have lined up
so far. So it might be an interesting thing to see if we might be able to put you on some recordings here and throw in a little poetry now and again as an interesting concept for K2.
Yeah,
well, thank
that.
You. Looking forward to the presentation tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, Egan 221, 222. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 27th of March, 2012. It was on this day, 1851, a group of miners called the Mariposa Battalion entered the Yosemite Valley, hoping to drive out a tribe of Indians so they could do some mining there. They thought they named the valley after the Indian tribe they were trying to drive out, but they got the name wrong. The tribe was called the Awanichi people. Yosemite was the name given them by other tribes as an insult. It meant those who kill. It was on this day, 1915, the woman known as Typhoid Mary was put into quarantine in a cottage in the Bronx. Mary Mallon. She was about 40, working as a cook in New York City, and every household she worked at came down with typhoid fever. Typhoid was common on battlefields. It may have killed more than 200,000 soldiers during the Civil War, but it was rarely seen in the wealthy households where she worked. In 1906, a doctor named George Soper noticed this strange pattern of outbreaks in wealthy homes, interviewed the families, found that they had all hired the same cook, and he finally tracked her down. Mary Mallon did not take it well when he asked her to provide a stool sample. She threatened him with a meat cleaver. He called the police, had her arrested. A stool sample was taken from her by force, and they discovered typhoid bacteria in her gallbladder. She admitted that she never washed her hands when she was cooking. They kept her in quarantine. She was released. She changed her name. She took up cooking again. She spread disease and death in her wake until they finally caught up with her again on Long Island, imprisoned her in the Bronx for the rest of her life, and she died of pneumonia in 1938. It's the birthday of John O'Farrell, born in Oxfordshire, England, 1962. For many years, he was a writer for The Spitting Image, a British satirical puppet TV show. Author of a nonfiction book entitled An Utterly Exasperated History of Modern Britain, or 60 Years of Making the Same Stupid Mistakes as Always. It's the birthday of the director and screenwriter Quentin Tarantino, born in Knoxville, 1963. Raised in Los Angeles, near the airport, high school dropout, worked in a big video store, watched movies all day, wrote screenplays. His first movie was Reservoir Dogs, 1992. 2 years later came his big hit, Pulp Fiction. Latest project, Django Unchained, currently in production. A western set in the Deep South. And it's the birthday of Julia Alvarez, born New York City, 1950, grew up in the Dominican Republic, came back to New York when she was 10, author of books about being caught between two cultures. Her novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, came out in 1991. Also wrote a nonfiction book, Once Upon a Quinceañera, about the tradition of throwing elaborate 15th birthday parties for young Latina women. Here's a poem for today by Michael Ryan, entitled Contentment. Fragile, provisional, it comes unbidden as evening. The children on the block called in to dinner that for tonight is plentiful, as if it had cost nothing, either in money or worry about money. Then evening deepens, and the street turns silent. There may be disasters, idling in driveways, and countless distresses sharpening, but all that matters most, that must be done, is done. Contentment, a poem by Michael Ryan from his collection This Morning, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Weather Bureau just issued an update forecast. They're calling now for mostly cloudy, lows around 36, southeast winds 15 miles per hour. They'll become light this evening. And Wednesday looks like partly sunny, highs around 47, northeast winds 10 miles per hour. Wednesday night, still the same, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain in the evening, lows around 15, east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. So nice weather for the next couple of days. It's 25 minutes before 4 o'clock, and the there's been a program that started a couple, 3 months ago here in Juneau called Mud Rooms, and Amanda Compton, who works here at K2, has been acting as the hostess for this thing. Here's Lori Scandling's story from Mud Rooms.
Our next guest is Lori Scandling. Lori was born and raised in Alaska. Her dad was a game warden, so she and her family lived in various places, including Haines, Kodiak, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. Lori never participated in normal children's games, though she did spend time shooting guns, fishing, canoeing, hiking, and using a bow and arrow. She's been in Juneau since... I have three question marks. What? 1978. And how do you know that? When she was passing through 34 years ago... There you go. She heard on an AM radio station that the station had fired the news director for fabricating a letter from an Alaska senator, so Lori drove to the station, presented herself, and was hired. She went from being a rabble-rouser in high school in Fairbanks to her current job as the assistant superintendent of schools in Juneau. She was also a reporter for a decade. Along her life journey, she's been a partner in the Bluecast political comedy troupe for 33 years and was a group fitness instructor for 15 years. Neither experience has been a guarantee of being funny or skinny. Lori Scandling.
Well, it occurred to me this morning that it was 5 years ago this morning that my mother died, and I kissed her goodbye. And I tell you that because really, she was the best storyteller of all. There were times we traveled together in cars, and between playing the ukulele, she would tell stories, and we'd go, that was a 60-miler. But for this theme, for the love of it, I want to tell you about my mom and my dad. My mom was 19 years old. And she came into her garage in a very ritzy suburb of Detroit, Michigan, with a box of brownies under her arm. And there was my father, who had driven to Alaska with her brother in a half-ton truck the year my mother graduated from high school, which would have been 1950. Now, my mother, throughout her life, was an impulsive romantic. And she once told me later that she had read Wuthering Heights, and the idea of making love with the game warden in front of the hearth ever remained with her. And my father, later to become my father, apparently making love on a hearth somewhere, had been a U.S. Fish and Wildlife agent, actually a colleague of Jay Hammond back in the early 1950s. And my mom was apparently romantically smitten. They had 10 dates. During which they kissed once, and he turned to her and said, "You smell like VO." That would be like saying you smell like Jägermeister today. He went back to Alaska, and throughout the fall, they wrote letters, and one of the letters implied he would like to have a fishing partner, and 3 weeks later, he was back in Detroit, and my parents got married. And my mother left. They drove across the country, and they ended up in Kenai, where my dad was stationed still with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and my mom lived in about a 19-foot trailer, and not too long afterwards had an infant, me, who had colic. So it went from a very wealthy lifestyle. Her father had been vice president of General Motors for many years. They had maids even during the Depression. She shopped for sport, for just a pastime, to this life on the Kenai Peninsula in a trailer, really kind of a trailer you hooked on the back of a truck and took places. So I'm going to zoom ahead. My mother had three children in 3 years, not unlike women of her generation. It's, as she said, well, you had an experience, and her experience was going to college for 1 year and then Europe, and then you got married. That was just expected. And by age 27, she had four children. And my parents could really not have been more different. I once said to my mother, "So if you were going to have your ashes anywhere, where would that be?" And she said, "At the Hudson Bay Shopping Mall in Detroit." Now, for my father, he said, "Well, I'd want to have somebody pack him up on a saddlebag of a horse, and that string of horses would go up into the Brooks Range and just leave me there." My parents had virtually diametrically opposed ideas of what fun was, what pleasure was, what pastime was. My father was a completely outdoor person, and I'm not kidding when I say I never played youth soccer. I mean, we were outdoors shooting pistols and bows and arrows, and that was just our life, hiking, hunting, fishing. And my mother's idea of sport, again, was shopping. Well, when I was 30 years old, I had infant twins, so I was vulnerable anyway. If you've ever had two babies at once, you're pretty fragile. They were little, and my mother called and said, I'm leaving your father, and I, like Virginia Woolf says, I want a room of one's own. And she did, and she had that room in Arizona, which was pretty far from the Kenai Peninsula at that point. So my parents ended up actually living apart for some years. They didn't get divorced. They lived apart until, at age 64 years old, after 37 years of marriage, which included conjugal visits between my parents when my father drove to Arizona during the winter time, he came out of the closet as a gay man. Now, let me tell you that theoretically, when other people are gay, it's great. When it's somebody that you thought you knew for your entire life, it's an adjustment. As my husband said, that's like saying John Wayne is gay. Now I kind of think maybe that's possible. There's really, no, there's no one now that would surprise me. My dad, I swear, was Mr. Alaska. We called him Mr. Alaska. He was the most virile person I think I ever knew. But you can only imagine from my mother who said, thanks a lot, 37 years, now I'm old and fat. I was young and beautiful at one time. Why didn't you just tell me then? And I asked that directly to my father. I said, you owe me some answers. And what he said was, hey, you know, it was World War II. Talk about don't ask, don't tell. That's not going to happen. And he said, and I really liked your mom a lot. She's really my best friend. And I really wanted to have children. So my parents were apart, and my father had a wonderful boyfriend, great guy, we loved him. And then my mother had a heart attack, and my parents had been divorced, and my mother said, would you remarry me for health insurance? And he said yes. So the three of them were at the wedding together, and she moved in with the two of them, and they nursed her back to health. And then she moved back to Arizona. She had come back to Alaska for her recovery. And then my dad moved down to Arizona with his partner. And my mother got this most wonderful apartment. If you've ever been to Bisbee, Arizona, it's an old mining town, not too unlike Juneau in so many ways. And she was getting ready to move in, and I went down to see her cute apartment with raw brick walls and just beams showing, really cute. And my dad was diagnosed with cancer. She never did unpack those boxes. She moved in with him. By then, he was not living with John anymore, and slept on the floor by his bed as she cared for him until he died. And that was for the love of it. Thank you.
Be part of a week of local music and festivities. Take part in the upcoming 38th Annual Alaska Folk Festival, April 9th through the 15th. The festival will air live in its entirety on KRNN 102.7 FM with streaming at krnn.org, starting at 7 p.m. each evening and noon on the weekend.
Northwind Architects and Good True Value Hardware are proud to support the upcoming 38th Annual Alaska Folk Festival, April 9th through the 15th.
It's 4:15. You're in tune with KTOO News, and I have guests in the studio who are all poetry-oriented here. These are three folks from the high schools here in Juneau. With me are Carson Barnes, Christopher Sims, and Raphael Sales. And all of you did and Kristen Garot here. Garot is here from TMHS as well, the instructor who puts this whole program together. All of you had to memorize a poem and then present it in front of your class or in front of the assembled multitudes when they actually had the competition. I'm having trouble seeing Carson here because I've got a screen. there's her good-looking voice. So, Chris, Carson, what did you perform? What did you read? What did you memorize?
I memorized "I Find No Peace" by Thomas Wyatt.
And is that like, I'm not familiar with the poet. Is this like modern? Is it?
It was, let's see, he wrote in like the 1800s.
Okay.
It's Old English. And it took me a while to learn it, but I loved it, and I like it, so, yeah.
What attracted you?
He's basically a tortured soul, and he's saying he craves life, but he still want, or he craves death, but he still wants to be alive, and he doesn't have anyone, and he's trying to find someone to love, and he can't, and... It kind of fit close to home at the time, and I don't know, I'm still learning. It's, I guess I have to read between the lines, so, yeah.
I think that's a wonderful summary of the nature of poetry, is reading between the lines. Christopher, what did you present?
Well, I presented "You Charmed Me Not With That Fair Face" by John Dryden.
And why did you choose Dryden?
Well, basically... Well, to be honest about it, it's short and it's easy to memorize.
But, an honest man, Diogenes, put away thy lantern.
Yes, but I feel like everyone can relate to the situation, you know, about everyone wants something they cannot have.
And did you know the poem before you chose it?
I did not.
Okay, so you went through like a lot of poems, and,
yes.
And this one sort of jumped out at the page,
yes.
Primarily because it was only that long. Okay, good. But then you got into it, it sounds like.
Yes, I did.
Did you enjoy doing this?
I did, very much.
Yeah. Raphael, what did you perform?
I did "Shake the Dust" by Anis Mujgani.
Okay, and that's more modern, right?
Yes.
Yeah, why did it appeal to you?
The context mentions a lot of, you know, different kinds of people, so a lot of people could relate, I thought.
Kristen, how many students are involved in this competition, or I don't know if you call it a competition or a presentation or exactly what?
It is a competition, and I organize it at Thunder Mountain, and there's another teacher who organizes it at JDHS, and then... It happens from the classroom level all the way to the state and national level. We have several hundred students here participating in Juno at the classroom level, and then each school has its own competition to have a slate of contestants, and then we had a city competition that had some students from JDHS and Thunder Mountain, and now we have the state competition here today over at the Jack at 5 o'clock. And that's why we're here today, to kind of bring some more people out to come see that possibly.
So that's open to the public.
That's open to the public. It's at 5 o'clock, and there are 10 students from all over Alaska who are participating. And then the winner from that competition will go to Washington D.C. next month for the national competition.
So if people come, what will happen?
They'll come and they'll see students do two, possibly three rounds of poetry. These memorized orations, recitations, and you'll see each student do one, and then each student will do a second, and then they'll narrow the field down, and then some students will do a third one.
Christopher, when I've seen this happen before, some of the presentations are extremely dramatic.
Yes.
A lot of almost acting going into it. Was yours such? Did you do it that way, or were you?
I did not perform it that way, though I could have.
Oh, okay.
For sure.
So you thought about maybe putting more of that to it?
Yes, I did.
Why'd
but
you hold
I
back?
Have really bad stage fright.
Oh. Okay. How many people were you addressing when you did this?
I would say 20 students.
So how was your stage fright level?
20.
Right up at 20, and it goes to a max of 30, right? Okay. So
10,
did it help?
Actually.
Did it help to do this?
It definitely did, and it opened my eyes, basically, to a lot of things.
To what?
Well, you should never be shy to express yourself, especially if it's something relating to a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm. So getting the message that Dryden wanted to, that you felt Dryden wanted to say across to these 20 people, kind of, it sounds like it became important to
you. Yeah, I'm pretty sure every one of them could relate to what I was saying.
Yeah. Carson, did you have that same experience?
No one really understood what my poem was about, and because it's in Old English. Until I read them my summary on the poem, and I said, you know, they can relate to it. Everyone craves different things. People get depressed, and it's basically telling them not to give up and that there's, like, hope.
So you talked to the class.
Yeah,
as well.
I did after I said the poem. So yeah. It was really embarrassing at first, and then I realized that you just have to get over it. Like, everyone's there for the same thing.
And people accepted then. Did you reread the poem afterward at all?
Yeah, I did, actually. Uh-huh. I read it for the school. Less embarrassing, but I got over it, and it was fun. It was really good. Good experience.
I once played a medieval shepherd in Middle English in a morality play, and it was quite an experience. We had to do the whole thing in Middle English, which was nobody could understand a word we were saying. We could have been doing cigarette commercials. It would have been the same thing. Raphael, did you incorporate acting into your presentation as well?
Actually, my poem was more like a spoken word ordeal, so it was more of, you know, just telling.
So the word was really the important thing. You didn't want to get in the way of the poem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a real strong consideration depending on the nature of the material. Go ahead.
Well, I'd just like to jump into this and say I did see Raph, we call him Raph, perform the poem, and I believe that a lot of acting was in there. It was very real, and I felt as if he was really into what he was saying.
Uh-huh.
Really good.
Which raises an interesting thing here. A lot of times when there's a kind of this kind of presentation or something like that, and you look at the class and basically they're waiting for the bell to ring. it sounds like, from what you just said, you were watching this guy. Okay, so it sounds like you got involved. Is that
this is kind of
an involving exercise?
Exactly. When a student's very involved in what they're doing, other students pay very close attention, and so, you know, even when the bell rings, some don't want to leave. You know, they want, what happens next?
Yeah, because this is the cool part, right? As opposed to when she's yammering on in front of the classroom about the nature of the tropes in the poetry. We didn't say that, did we? Okay. Go ahead.
Turn the mic. It's kind of amazing.
There you go.
At Thunder Mountain, we will have the school competition, and the auditorium's full, and we have 400 students who are there watching their fellow classmates perform poetry, and it's a really amazing experience to just watch that happen and that interaction and how, I mean, sometimes there's assemblies and kids are raucous or whatever, and these kids are quiet and respectful and listening to their peers and really appreciating the work and energy and effort that these, you know, the poets, the students who are reciting poetry give out to that. And it's a cool thing to watch.
Yeah, we kind of hope that'll be the atmosphere that's over at the Jack. And again, this performance at the Jack starts at 5 o'clock. I want to call it performance. I'm not sure what you call
it. It's a performance, oration.
Yeah.
It starts at 5 o'clock, and I bet it'll go about an hour and a half.
Oh, okay.
Till the very end.
Of course, no charge.
No charge. Yeah. Everyone's invited.
Right.
Come on over, yeah.
Okay, so any gifts for us, things somebody ought to note if they were thinking about doing this next year? You've all been through this now. There'll be some classmates coming
through. I would just add, bring your energy to the table. That's what I'll say. You know, and pick a poem that you can relate to. It's not really much of what other people can understand, but bring a poem that you can relate to, because if you can relate to it, then you can put more of yourself into it and get it across.
Okay, good enough. Well, thank you very much. The performance starts at 5 o'clock at the Jack. Walk on over there, and how many poets, again, will be performing? So there's a total of 10 from all over the state, and each of them may do as many as 3 presentations in the course of this. And this is to decide some kind of prize, is that correct?
Yeah, there's the national prize is a scholarship amount. That's pretty significant, pretty hefty scholarship for the winner, personal scholarship to be used for their education. And the school, I believe, also gets some monies to use for educational purposes at the school, the winner school. But it's a pretty hefty sum for the scholarship, so it's kind of exciting.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Carson Barnes, Christopher Sims, Raphael Sales, thank you so much for presenting your material, and thanks so much for telling us the story of it.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. While nearly a third of North American bird species are in decline, many birds that depend on wetlands are thriving. Duck breeding populations in 2009 were an estimated 25% above historical averages, with gadwall, green-winged teal, and northern shoveler numbers more than 70% above the long-term average. Wood ducks, such as those we're hearing here, have increased more than 200% in the past 40 years. Although conditions on the breeding grounds have improved since the drought years of the 1980s, human action has made a huge difference. Many wetland birds have increased steadily in numbers since the emphasis of government policy shifted from draining to protecting wetlands. Waterfowl hunters have provided hundreds of millions of dollars to conserve and restore wetlands. And it's not just ducks and geese that benefit. Nearly one quarter of all U.S. birds, such as this Virginia rail, rely on freshwater wetlands. Yes, challenges remain, but wetland birds respond to our efforts. For example, in spring, in wetland-rich areas protected by conservation programs in the Dakotas, you can find more than 100 breeding pairs of ducks on a single square mile of prairie. Learn more at birdnote.org.
Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, you can hear Jeff talk to Kevin Roth, who will be performing next week at the Downtown and Valley Libraries. He's a family entertainer. Kelly Manning will drop in to highlight upcoming classes that are being held at the Canvas. Beth Weigel will be here to talk about a healthier Juno, and Angela Gowdy from Rotaract will join us to talk about Friday's Chili Fest. We'll learn about the week at Eagle Crest, then you'll have Writer's Almanac music and much more tomorrow at 3 when Jeff takes over again for Juno Afternoon. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO's also broadcasts on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're heard on K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM 88.1. Huna is served by K220BT, that's on 91.9 in Huna. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on 89.9. The call sign is K210 AS. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN, our sister station, is heard on digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found on channel 873. You can also listen to our live stream on www.ktoo.org.
Time to think what time could do for us. Really nothing. Why tonight did you break my heart?